The following interview is with John T. Labby, conducted on September 26, 1978, at his home in Beaverton. In it, he talks about the logging and lumber industry in the area, particularly concentrating on the individual mills, the individual owners, and the general economic aspects of the lumber industry. Good morning, Mr. Labby.
Good morning.
Could you, to start out with, I would like a little information on yourself, as far as where you were born and where you grew up.
Well, I was born in Portland. My father before me was born in Portland, and he was a doctor, an obstetrician. He was not only my father, but he was also my doctor. And both my sister and myself were born in a little maternity hospital, which you might say was his hospital, and it was there on Overton Street, 23rd. Mm-hmm. Wilcox Memorial Hospital is part of.
Mm-hmm. So how old are you now then?
Well, I'm 66. I was born in 1911. And at that time we lived on Westover Terrace at the near the head of Lovejoy Street, just off Cornell Road. I lived there for something like 60 years.
Mm-hmm. So you've been involved in logging yourself or?
Oh yes,
when and where?
I've been logging all my active working life. And even earlier than that, when I was in school, I used to spend the summers working in the woods mm-hmm. locally around here, primarily in cutting wood, hauling wood. It was a good summer job for kids.
Since you have retired, Mr. Labby, you've written, done quite a bit of research on your own on the logging and written several books.
Yes, I have.
And your emphasis, I know that you know a little bit about the logging mills and companies in individual counties, particularly Washington County.
Yes, I've followed them because I've been interested, and I can remember them as a kid around the county. I never actually did any logging myself in this particular area. Mine was around the state on the
coast. Could you give me an idea of how many logging companies, past and present, operated in this county, and when they had their start?
Well,
and their peak times.
Yeah, they started logging here quite early. As a matter of fact, the valley itself was never a logging area. The logging was done in the hills around it. As nearly as I can determine, a lot of this country was open meadowland. It wasn't heavily timbered. And the earliest that I have any record of was there at Cedar Mill, which is about, roughly 1860. Mr. Jones and, I believe his name was Jones, yeah, and Mr. Jones and his son had a little cedar mill there at Cedar Mills. And the Cornell Road goes over the top of what was the dam for their log pond. And the story that I got on it was that the two of them worked this together, and they would close the gate on the dam and back up the water, and then they would fill the pond with cedar logs, which were cut in that gully up there through, I've forgotten, there's a park up in there, but at any rate, it's alongside Cornell Road.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the pond was full, they'd open the gate, and that provided water for the water wheel, and they would saw up the lumber. Then they'd load that on a wagon, and the old man would haul it into Portland, and his son would fill the pond with water and with logs again. And that's, of course, the origin of the name Cedar Mill. Then later, they moved to Portland and started the steam sawmill, which became the Jones Lumber Company. And that was in the area where John's Landing now is. And
how about some of the lumber mills in the western part of the county. Were they quite numerous, am I right?
Well, they were numerous, but they came later on. That part of the valley was slower in developing, you know. This area was filled with small mills that merely served local trade, little farm mills or they weren't large, you know. There was no way to get the lumber out. They had to haul it away with wagons, and of course there were no roads to speak of. What there were only passable in the summertime. In the winter they were just axle deep mud, you know. So they served the local trade. The larger companies didn't come in until they built the line, the rail line to Tillamook. And that was about 1911, I think, roughly speaking. That's about the same age I am, you see. And that gave access to all that timber in the Coast Range, which was the primary timberland source for the Washington County.
So once the lumber mill or the railway line was built, who was the, where did the first mill start to crop up then?
Well,
they had an advantage of transportation.
So you'll see it, that line was slow in building, but the first section was built from Hillsboro to Buxton. And of course the first mills were in that area. They were around banks. And then as the line extended, the loggers moved on with it. And really, the largest operations were centered around timber and Cochrane. Of course, that reaches your county line, you see. But the major operations were in that area.
Now, the timber and Cochrane lumber mills, were they run by a man, Wheeler?
Yeah, C.H. Wheeler. He was an interesting individual, from all I can determine. He was a cruiser, and he was born and raised in Clatskanie. And when the eastern operators became interested in western timber, he had the job of going around and locating this timber for the eastern owners. And he bought up tremendous tracts of timber all through the Nehalem Valley for eastern people. And
who were some of these eastern people?
Well, John Dubois was one of them, and he built the big mill at Wheeler. And Wheeler, of course, was named for C.H. Wheeler. And he was in partnerships there, and then later on he bought his own timber in the Cochrane area, and then he set up his own operation under his own name. The Wheeler Lumber Company was really owned by John Dubois of Pennsylvania.
Was he a businessman or?
He was a large timber operator. He had interests all over the Pennsylvania area and out here as well. But Wheeler didn't start on his own until he purchased this timber around Cochrane. And then he built a mill at Cochrane, and then later on he bought another mill at timber, and he was the major operator really in that area, although there were others.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you're acquainted with Tony Losman.
Yeah.
And he was the man that bought the Miller Lumber Company, and
yeah, he bought.
Could you tell me a little bit about the initial company before he moved in, and then he came in and purchased?
Yeah, I've talked to Tony about that. He's not entirely clear on it himself, unfortunately. He's approaching 90 years of age, and his memory is not what it was. But from all I can tell, there was a small operation there, Miller Cox, I believe was the name, and there was a fellow by the name of D.H. McCall who was operating in there, and their operations were just east of timber. There was a switch there just east of the timber yard limits on the Southern Pacific. The switch was called Reliance, and that was where the line switched off to the Sunset operations. And as nearly as I can tell, that's where these operators were started. And he came along and bought the timber in behind, and then he took over these operations and acquired some of the equipment.
Could you tell me a little bit of background on Mr. Losman and how he got his start, and why he became interested in buying land up in this area?
He was kind of an interesting individual. He was a German, and there was a large timber company by the name of Stanley Smith. Now, they got their start up in the La Grande area, and they came down to the west side of the Cascades, just after the turn of the century. They bought the railroad at Goble, which later became Clark and Wilson Lumber Company. They had that for a short period, and then they sold it, and they moved up to the Hood River area. And they had extensive operations up around Hood River, and that's the time they sent for Tony Losman, who was living in Germany at the time, and he showed me the letter that he received inviting him to come over here and go to work. And he started working for them up at Hood River. They had an interesting operation. They floated logs out. They built a series of dams, and they would float the logs from up the head of this small lake down to the dam, and then they would open the dam and float them down into the next one. And then they got down to the sawmill, and they sawed them up, and then the lumber was flumed on down to the railroad. And he worked up there for them. Mm-hmm. For quite a while before he started on his own.
Speaking of flumes, were there any flumes in this area or that were used in the mills?
No, I don't know of any in Washington County. There were flumes down along the Columbia River, but I don't know of any mm-hmm. right here in this county.
Well, back then to Mr. Losman, could you tell me what time about he came into this area up here at Sunset?
Well,
why, you think?
Well, I don't know. I couldn't tell you exactly why, except that he was working his way up in the industry, and he worked into the operation of the East Side Mill and Lumber Company, and there was a miller involved in that. Whether this was the same miller in Cox Miller, I don't know. It might well have been. But Mr. Miller had this sawmill, which would be under the east end of the Selwood Bridge, or at the east ferry landing there. The piling, I think, are still visible between the old ferry landing and the Oaks Park. And the buildings under the end of the bridge were part of the planing mill. But Tony got involved with them, and then he took over the logging operations out in the timber area, and he provided the logs for that mill. And then he expanded his logging, and he bought some timber of his own and sold that on the open market through Rock Creek Logging Company there at Kesey, which was just adjacent to the East Side Logging Company, which was part of the East Side Mill and Lumber Company operation. Tony ran them both. But they were entirely separate. Even the rolling stock and locomotives and so on were not mixed up. They were kept separate. The interesting thing is that the Rock Creek locomotive was lettered for East Side Logging Company, although it belonged to Tony. So these things get very involved.
But did he own, wasn't there another lumber company, right? What is now the Sunset Highway that he owned?
Well, Sunset Logging Company, yes. He was involved in that originally. That was set up right at that, what's now Wolf Creek Junction on the Sunset Highway, where the Timber Vernonia Road crosses the Sunset Highway.
There was quite a logging camp there.
Oh yeah, there was a big camp there. Of course, originally the Sunset Highway wasn't there. That was the main highway between Timber and Vernonia. The camp was on either side of the road, and in the large meadow, which is just south of the junction there, he had the engine house, and then that would be on the southeast corner of the intersection, and on the southwest corner they had the warehouse and some yards where they stored machinery and that sort of thing.
The people that worked in this mill, they there was an actual lumber
camp
there.
There wasn't a mill there. That was just a logging operation. And the logs were brought over to Reliance Junction and hauled in on the Southern Pacific. And the logs were dumped at Oswego, mm-hmm. at the dump there, and then they were sold on the open market. I suppose that East Side Mill and Lumber Company probably had a prior claim on them, but Tony, that was his major operation in Washington County, but he operated all over the western part of Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'd like to change emphasis a little bit here.
Yeah.
Now, you've written a book called Railroading in the Woods.
Yes.
And now, could you explain the role or the importance of the railroads, and particularly the Southern Pacific Railroad and the spur lines, to these lumber mills? Why they were so needed?
Well, of course, you see, the timber in those days was large, old-growth timber. We're not familiar with it today, but the logs were up 4 or 5 feet through. They were very large and difficult to handle. And there was no way of getting them to a market until there was a rail line. We didn't have any paved roads, and we didn't have any trucks or things that could handle it on a road anyway. It was horse-drawn equipment, so you were limited. Unless you could get logs into water and float them to a market, there was no way to get them out. And as soon as the railroad pushed into an area, that gave the loggers access. And then in order to get from that railroad to their operation, they had to build rail lines of their own. And theirs were rather crude. Anything to get out to the mainline railroad. And they made the whole thing was the railroad. This standard railroad procedure had become pretty traditional, and it was well regulated by federal authorities and so on. But the loggers were not bound by any of this tradition or any of this regulation, so they used their own imaginations. The matter of equipment and rail lines.
What were some of the things that they did?
Well, they did a lot of things. For instance, they developed the disconnected logging truck. Instead of having a car put the logs on, they just had a truck that they put under each end of the log. And the weight of the logs held these together and made a car out of them, you see. But they could be any length. If they wanted to bring out logs 80 feet long, they just spaced these trucks to support the logs, and they could bring them out. And of course, on mainline railroad couldn't have handled anything like that because of the curves and so forth. And in addition, of course, they couldn't use air brakes on them because there was no way of connecting the train. So they were all handled with hand brakes. The brakeman had to walk along the logs from one end of the car to the other and set the brake wheel on the truck by hand.
Could this be dangerous then? Was there any accidents?
Oh yes, it was dangerous, and it's always dangerous in the woods if you're not cautious. If you're careful, why, you're safe. But
do you know of any spectacular accidents that happened up in the county?
Well, there was a spectacular accident. Probably the most spectacular occurred up near Cochrane. On the Fiesel had an operation up there, and going out to work one day, one morning, it was frosty and snow on the ground, and as the train was crossing a trestle, it was a curved trestle, the tracks suddenly contracted from the cold and it pulled the tracks off the trestle. They had not been nailed down, oddly enough. I don't know why that might be, but the tracks pulled off and the train landed in the canyon, and quite a number of people were killed.
Boy.
But, of course, the rails were subject to expansion and contraction in the earlier days, particularly. More often, they were bothered with what they called sun kinks. You get a very hot summer day, and the expansion would cause the rails to buckle.
Did this accident occur on the trestle? Or
right on the trestle.
Were there, speaking of trestles, were there, I know that there were a few up in this area, and a lot of them are gone now.
Oh,
yes. Were they utilized quite a bit up here?
Yes, extensively, because you see, in the earlier days, they didn't have earth-moving equipment. Excavation had to be done with pick and shovel, or with horse-drawn equipment. They had those scrapers, you know. And so they avoided excavating as much as possible. It was easy to take poles out of the woods and drive piling, and they used trestles extensively.
Were these, I would imagine, I'm amazed by the sturdiness of the trestles and how much weight they supported.
Well, yeah, they loggers had a tendency to build things overly strong. They weren't always aesthetically pleasing, but as the logger used to say, they were hell for stout anyway. they were not engineers. It was as well, they resisted the trained engineers. The loggers had the feeling that a man had to learn the business from the ground up, and a college-trained engineer was looked on as an interloper, you know. They were not accepted readily. But the loggers, of course, not being bound by engineering practice, they came up with some innovations that probably an engineer would never have thought of. But on the other hand, they made some serious goofs. There have been instances in which trestles were put up and were not properly braced and collapsed for that reason. There was one in particular down the Coos Bay area where, it was quite a spectacular trestle, but they'd braced it. The side bracing was on it, but they hadn't braced it longitudinally. Apparently they didn't realize that was necessary, and the first train over it pushed it right down, and it just collapsed like a pile of jack straws.
Speaking of locomotives and rail lines, there was a man by the name of Mr. Eccles.
Yeah.
That was he involved in the building of rail lines?
Well, yes, David Eccles was involved. He was quite an extensive operator up in the eastern Oregon area. He was a Mormon and operating out of Utah. And the Mormons had to move into the timber to supply lumber for their development in the Utah area. And they moved into eastern Oregon near La Grande, Baker, down through there. And they, as soon as the railroad got into that area, they set up mills all through there. And that was a Mormon country, and Eccles was involved in that, and he was—he's built the Sumter Valley Railroad, which was a narrow gauge operation that went from Baker as far as Prairie City, and of course that was a lumber operation. They haul logs and lumber out of that, but he also had interest down the down the river. He built the big mill at D out above Hood River, and he built that Mount Hood Railroad. And he had an operation across the river on the Washington side also. And then he moved into this area. He had a sawmill down in Columbia County out of Clatskanie, and he built a sawmill near Banks that operated for a short period until a forest fire destroyed that timber. That operation. I'm not sure just where the mill was located, but nearly as I can tell, his railroad that served the mill was on the hills just to the west of the highway, Highway 47 there, right where the Sunset Highway and the Banks Highway join, you know. And a forest fire passed through there, and that stopped that operation. But then later on, they bought all this timber that later became Oregon American. He operated as Oregon Lumber Company in most of his operations, and set up the mill site at Vernonia, and they're going to have their operation out of there as Oregon Lumber Company, and they built the, or at least they started, I guess they actually built the railroad from Banks to Vernonia, which was built as the Portland, Astoria, and Pacific. But they ran out of funds before they completed it and had to sell out, and that became Oregon American. They retained the Oregon part of the title. But his original plan had been to build a mill on the Willamette Slough down below Cornelius Pass, and he hoped to buy the United Railways, which was the line that ran from Banks through North Plains to Linton. But it turned out that Jim Hill didn't want to sell that line because he'd planned it as access to the Tillamook area. So ultimately, he bought the line of Vernonia.
So there's a lot of business competition between the people that are trying to start the mills then.
Oh yes, there's competition there, but they were also involved with the competition between Harriman and Hill, both of whom were headed for Tillamook, you see. And Hill had a right-of-way down the Wilson River, which was the best route into Tillamook. But Harriman, in order to beat him out, he rushed construction down through Timber and Cochrane and down the Salmonberry and got to Tillamook first. But it was the less attractive route. And of course, Tillamook's mm-hmm. been stuck with it ever since. But Hill, when he got just outside of Banks, it was called Wilkesboro then, just a little community there where the line crossed the Southern Pacific, just outside of Banks. Then he built an extension up to as far as Glenwood under the title of the Gales Creek and Wilson River Railroad. And that was a continuation of his plans to get to Tillamook. Mm-hmm. And from Glenwood, he planned a tunnel through the divide and then go down the Wilson River to get into Tillamook. But that's as far as he got, Glenwood.
Mm-hmm. Lavi, you were a Gypo logger yourself.
Yes.
And you know a little bit, you know a lot about Gypo logging, I would imagine. And I was just curious, did they have much of a, were there many in this area, or what was their role or importance? Or
well, yes, there were a lot of Gypo operators around here because the Gypo is the small operator who goes around and either logs under contract or buys small tracts of timber. And of course, that's mainly what was available through here. There were Gypo operators that logged all over the Chehalis Mountain, for instance. And
before we go any farther, yeah, could you describe what a Gypo logger is?
Well, a Gypo logger is, he's a small operator. He's operating with limited capital. And normally what we used to do, we would find a small tract of timber, make arrangements with the owner to pay him on a, rather than buy it outright, and most of us couldn't afford to do that, we'd pay him by the thousand as it was taken out, you see. And then most of them would go out and get all their equipment on credit. And usually after you got through, you probably about even again, you see. What you were doing, you were making yourself a job. And
so it must have been fairly hard for independents to survive.
It was. There weren't too many of them. I think probably the most successful in this county was probably Lida. Lida was the operator. He lived out around between Forest Grove and Dilley when I talked to him, but he worked around the Glenwood area. And as a matter of fact, he's the one on whose operation the Tillamook fire was supposed to have started, according to Ellis Lucia. I wasn't aware of that, but he owned that area around Glenwood, what is now that trolley museum. Those fellas made their arrangements with Lida to acquire that property. And I'm sure that Lida took it over after the Consolidated Timber Company folded, you see. So he came in to clean up and probably get what little salvage was left there after the burn, or before the burn. No, let me see. If he was there, he must have been there before Consolidated Timber. It had to have been, because they came in after the fire. But at any rate, he was working in that area. And there was a number of others. There were the Hooden Piles. Let me see. No, they would have been in Yamhill County. They were a little further down. They worked for me, too, at one time. But Lida was the main one. There was another fellow who lived at Glenwood by the name of Thayer. And I hired him as a cat skinner. And later on, he became quite a large gypo operator on his own.
What is a cat skinner?
Well, he operated the Caterpillar tractor, see, doing the yarding. He was a whiz, too, that guy. We had one tractor and one logging arch, and we averaged 75,000 feet a day, and we put in as much as 150,000 feet in one day. He was a highball operator, and as I say, later on, he operated on his own, they tell me, and was quite successful. He's passed away now, but his last operation, he had a gravel pit around in the county somewhere. I've forgotten the title it was under. It was in the Alloa area somewhere.
You told me earlier about a man named Mr. Marmeyer
from Cornelius. Max Meyer.
Max Meyer.
Yeah, Max Meyer, yeah.
He had quite a bit of trouble there.
Oh yeah, he was on the bottom of the totem pole. As a gypo logger on a scale of 1 to 10, he was probably a 1 or a 2. He was a character. He was a former baseball player, and when I knew him, he was quite elderly, but he must have had quite a reputation as a baseball player. He got his name in the sports section every now and then. And he always showed up for the old-timers ball games. Big raw-bone sort of a character. He lived at Burlington, just where the Cornelius Pass Road meets the Columbia River Highway. They're right close to the school, across the road from the store. And he would log small tracts of timber, farm lots and that sort of thing, and he had a bunch of old junk. He had some old steam donkeys, and anybody that he could con into working for him, you know, bringing some equipment. And he logged along the skyline, and he logged down through the Tualatin Valley, along around West Union and places like that, a number of different farm lots that had, say 10, 15 acres of timber. He'd go in and get it out. And I don't think, I can't see that he even made a living, but he lasted a long time, so he must have come out some way.
But he operated with old used equipment?
Oh yeah, old junky equipment and stuff, and you know, moving that around from one place to another was quite a project. Those old steam donkeys, and then of course this was in the day and age when most of the fellas were using small gasoline donkeys. And when you set up a steam donkey, then you had to arrange for the fuel, and you had to get water lines to it and all that stuff. And that was a lot of work to go to log 5 or 10 acres. And usually it was not a very high grade of timber. If it was old growth, it was old wood logs, you know, and if it was second growth at that time, second growth was not in great demand. This would have been, in the 30s. But he always managed, he was always working someplace. And as I was telling you the other day, in one place out here near West Union, he was logging in a swale that was kind of marshy, a lot of alder and ash, stuff like that in there, and he took those trees and cut them down, and then he'd wrap them with cable to make mats, and he laid these mats of poles in the swamp, and then he hauled over those with his trucks. It was like hauling on a deep pile rug, you know, and the water squished out of there and mud squished out, but he got in and out. And I don't know, he must have spent twice as much time getting set up as he did logging. I don't know how he ever came out on that.
So do you think he's a good example of the adversities most of the loggers?
The thing about it was that you were independent, you see. You logged for yourself, and you could thumb your nose at anybody. You may not get rich, but at least you were your own boss.
Well, Mr. Labby, we talked about the small Gippo independent loggers, and we talked a little bit about some of the mill owners. And so this sort of brings in the idea of who controlled and ran the industry. Was it mostly, in this area particularly, was it mostly large organizations that owned the mills, or were they mostly individually owned and set up? And
in this area...
Where did the money come from and where did it go?
Well, it's kind of interesting. At that time, loggers primarily were independent companies, and they sold their logs on the open market. We put logs in the river, and these rafts were made up, towed down the river, and then they were tied up at various places along the river, and then they were sold to the highest bidder. And most of the sawmills were along the river for the simple reason that the woods operations had a limited life, and if the sawmill was on the river, they were tributary to any operations around the state, because by the use of the railroads on the river, well, you could get the logs to the mill. And there weren't too many mills built in the woods, but one of the few exceptions, of course, was the timber area. They had sawmills up there, and they were there for some length of time. But generally speaking, there weren't. A lot of the logs went, for instance, to the pulp mill at Newburgh. They bought logs at that Newburgh mill. Their logs came from up on the Mackenzie River, up around Fall City area on the Rickrail Creek and the Luckamute River, you know. Spaulding logged all through that area, and he bought logs from every place. But most of the logs out of this area went into the Columbia River, and most of them were dumped at the Oswego dump. Southern Pacific operated that, and that was below the falls, you see. Now, I logged into the Yamhill River at Lafayette, and those logs had to go down through the locks of the Yamhill, you see, and then down the Willamette to Oregon City through the locks and then down into the Columbia. But they got down there, and I could remain competitive. Now, of course, there was a big sawmill on the lake at Carlton, and a lot of the logs were dumped in there too. But generally speaking, the market was the river. That determined the prices.
Speaking of rivers, were there any, was the Tualatin River ever utilized for
In the early days, it was, yes. It's hard to believe now, but in the early days, not only was it used for logs, but they also had boat service on it, stern wheelers on the Tualatin River. And there was one problem there at the lower end. Of course, there's shallow and there are rapids or riffles down there. And the major part of what was shipped down there was for the paper mills at Oregon City. Of course, tributary to the river with the cottonwood and white fir and that sort of thing, which was the good pulp timber. And a lot of it was sent down as cordwood. And for a time, there was a railroad that operated, the electric road that operated out of West Lynn. And that was extended almost to Oregon City. And up above this shallow area on the Tualatin. And they used to haul logs from below the locks up above for the paper mills. And they would also haul from the Tualatin River down to the paper mills. And they could also haul clear down and dump down near Oswego. So that gave you a pretty good two-way street for handling material. But generally speaking, I'd say the Tualatin was not a popular driving stream.
Mm-hmm.
It was
so the introduction of the railroads was really a boon then.
The Tualatin, like most of the rivers around here, was the primary artery of travel until they got roads and railroads and that sort of thing. But it was not well adaptable to that traffic.
So did the people that worked for the Wheelers and the Losmans and the owners, did they see much of the money, or were they strictly?
No. Generally speaking, most of the operators, large and small, didn't make a lot of money. The few who made the money in retrospect are the ones who owned the timber and the land. Those who moved in just to cut it and move out again really didn't make a lot of money.
This brings up the idea of wage and working conditions. And from what I understand, the unions and organizations such as the International Woodworkers of the World and Woodworkers Union didn't really have much effect as far as proselytizing members.
No, they didn't. The loggers were a strange bunch. They were something like the cowboys, I guess. They were very nomadic, and they treasured their freedom. They didn't want anybody dictating to them where they could work and when they could work. And they used to wander from camp to camp, and if you wanted a good crew and keep a good crew, you had to have a good cook and a good cookhouse. That was the first order of business, and then of course working conditions beyond that were of some effect. Some of the operators were known as highball operators, and they worked the men too hard, and they weren't too careful about working conditions. Flora was notorious that way, I think, more than he deserved to be, perhaps, but most of them...
Who is this man then?
Flora, Joe Flora. Well, actually, Flora didn't work right in Washington County. He worked down in Columbia County, and he worked in Yamhill County, but he had the rep. The story is that somebody got killed on his operation. They just threw him back of a stump till quitting time and kept right on going. Some of the operators, if there was an accident, they shut everything down for the day, you know. But Flora, he didn't. He didn't shut down till quitting time.
We talked a little bit about the dangers of logging. So what if a logger was injured, was there any... retribution, or did he have any chance to get back to work, or was he just pretty much out of luck?
He was pretty much out of luck, really, to begin with, and then later on they began, the courts began to allow them damages lawsuits, but gosh, it was kind of rough to begin with compared to what we know today. We fellas didn't think anything too much about it, really, in those days. It was one of those things. You took your chances wherever you worked. But if the operator was grossly negligent, well, they had recourse to the courts. But a $5,000 judgment doesn't sound like very much. I suppose it was quite a bit in those days. But I can think of many cases where the fellas really got a raw deal if you stop to think about it.
Mm-hmm. We alluded to earlier the Tillamook fires.
Yeah.
And that had a giant effect on the logging industry in this area.
Oh yes, it did. The Tillamook, the timber on the west slope of the Coast Range down through there was probably some of the nicest in the world. And it would have lasted for another generation or so as green timber. Probably today would have been a sustained yield operation, you know, but that just disappeared overnight, you might say, in that Tillamook fire. Something like 300,000 acres burned. And unless you had an opportunity to see that at first hand, you couldn't visualize what it meant. It
did it put a lot of the loggers that were working out in the woods out of work?
Well, no, because
how did it affect the economics?
Well, they hadn't gotten into that timber, you see, yet. They were just working around the edges, and of course it affected the future of the business, but it didn't have an immediate effect. Actually, the immediate effect was that they went in there to salvage it, and they put a lot of people to work. But when that was gone, there wasn't any more. So it was something like 10 years delayed, you see. Then you began to feel the effects of it, but by that time people didn't really realize.
So did the fire destroy any of the operating mills or the rail
no.
lines and trestles?
No, very few. That's the first fire. The second fire did, because they were in there.
That was 1945.
No, let me see. The first fire was 33, and then
39.
Yeah, they were 6 years apart. 39 fire was the one that did the big damage. I went in and bought some timber down on the South Fork of the Trask River, and in order to get in, I built a truck road up to reach the railroad grade of Flores, and then I followed that railroad grade. But there was the remains of camps that had burned, and I remember there were 22 steam donkeys standing out there that had been burned, and miles of railroad track. So that did, I think there were something like 16 trestles that burned. That did do a lot of damage in that area.
As we're talking a little bit about the equipment, and as the years went on, the equipment advance and technology became more efficient. I'm curious, did the small organizations, were they able to afford the better equipment as time went on, and just how expensive was that equipment for them?
Well, I'll tell you, the loggers were a peculiar breed of men. They were fascinated by equipment, and they would overextend themselves to buy equipment. They bought equipment they didn't need, and of course the manufacturers kept coming up with more and more attractive toys for the loggers to buy, and in most instances they overextended themselves on equipment. They bought sophisticated equipment that was beyond their needs. But generally speaking, the larger operators course, that the ones that could afford the railroads and the trains and that sort of thing, they bought this, these big donkeys, they bought these skidders, tower skidders and all of that stuff. Those things weighed 300 tons, you know, and they took those in over their rickety railroads. But the smaller operator, he was kind of limited until the era of the Caterpillar. And when the tractors and the trucks came along, why, the small operator was able to compete pretty well, because he didn't need as much equipment and he could afford the same quality equipment on a smaller basis. But in the earlier days, if he went in as a gypo, say salvaging or cleaning up behind a big operation or something like that, why, they usually provided the equipment on a lease basis, so he was able to mm-hmm. acquire or have equipment that he could mm-hmm. operate with.
Trying to think of, I think we've covered quite a bit of ground here. Do you have other information that we probably could can contribute that would be valuable to talk about? Or
of course, I could talk for all day probably, but I'm not sure just what you want or that sort mm-hmm. of thing. But I would say this: if you want to anytime come back and enlarge on this at a later date, well, that's fine.
Yeah, I think that might be best, you know. Give me a chance to listen to the tape and find out what information we have, and then I could send it back to you, and maybe you can make additions or corrections, and then we can maybe work out some more information.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
I think we've covered quite a bit. I'm really happy with what we have.
Why don't you then assess what you've got and...